Thank you, and I'd like to thank the organizers for organizing a splendid conference and for inviting me to talk. I've been impressed as a newcomer to this field, a relative newcomer, at how you all have taken these difficult concepts and turned them into talks that are precise and compelling. This talk will be different. This talk is going to be speculative. And this talk is going to be provisional, but I hope if you bear with me, you'll also, that I'll convince you that the ideas that it contains are somewhat promising. These ideas go back to 2013. They've been worked on mainly by people at Stanford or called Stanford, from the early adopters all the way down to the beta testers that I am now joining in on. And it's going to be about wormholes, complexity, computation, and action, more or less in that order. So I'll start with wormholes. This you probably recognize as a partial metric on for a black hole in ADS space-time. And I can draw the Penrose diagram for that. The Penrose diagram suppresses the two-sphere and just looks at the RT part with time running up here and space horizontally. And it starts on the left with a sphere of infinite radius, the ADS boundary. And you know that if you send in a light ray from the boundary, it'll cross the horizon at R Schwarzschild and then hit the singularity at R equals zero. But you perhaps also know that that's not the only way to draw a line in this direction. You could also draw a horizontal line, a space-like line, and trace the size of the two-sphere as you do that. And the first people to do that discover something surprising, which is that the two-sphere starts off very large at infinity, then gets smaller and smaller and smaller as it approaches the horizon, and then gets larger and larger and larger again, and expands out once more to another infinity. So this is the Kruskal extension, maximal extension of the black hole. And sure enough, there's another R equals infinity out here at on the other side, through the wormhole. And if you complete it, there is a past singularity 2. Okay, so consider this point here. There's a huge sphere. As I trace along here, the sphere gets smaller and smaller and smaller, until there's some minimal sphere at this point, and then the sphere gets larger and larger and larger again until you hit the right boundary, at which point the sphere is infinitely large again. That's what happens at t equals zero slice, this zero time slice. I can also take other slices and ask what the geometry of the wormhole looks like there. And as you can sort of see from the Penrose diagram, if I take this slice, it looks like the region inside the wormhole is longer. Of course, the Penrose diagram is a very unreliable indicator of that, but in this case, it's true. What happens is that the wormhole doesn't really change its thickness. It just gets long. And as I take a slice higher and higher and higher, depending on exactly how I take it, the length of this wormhole grows without bound. Okay. And so, again, depending on exactly how I take that slice, the area of that wormhole is the same as the area of the black hole. It's the entropy over h bar, whereas the length of that wormhole grows like time. Yes?
So that would need to have the slice really centralizes the sample in the wrong dimensional quantity is smaller if you take the
You're saying that this isn't h over s over h bar, it's a half of s over h bar? Yeah. Yeah, good. I think you've misinterpreted my commitment to rigor, but...
In general, as you take that thing up, it increases the thickness. If you took it all the way to the singularity,
everything you're saying is true, and will be explored in more detail as the talk progresses. Veronica's making the fine point that if I took my slice and shoved it up to hit the singularity, this really would go to zero size. I'm not going to do that. I will describe what I am going to do later. Okay, so the length of this slice, if I take some covariant prescription for matching slices across, the length of that slice is proportional to t. In fact, I can be a bit more precise. It's equal to t left plus t right. So there's a boundary time on the left, t left. There's a boundary time on the right, t right, which is sometimes taken to point downwards for good reasons, but that's not what I'm going to do. I'm going to consider it to point upwards. And then there's a fact, which is to do with the time-like killing vector that this space possesses. The time-like killing vector is going to move me up on the left, down on the right, and then it's going to move me in a space-like direction inside the black hole. And that means that if I take a covariant prescription, the length of the wormhole that gets me from here to here can only be a function of t left plus t right. It cannot be a function of t left minus t right. In other words, if I choose two antipodal points, here and here, because they're antipodal, I could just change coordinates and boost them back to the center, and I would necessarily find that the length of the wormhole connecting those two points would be the same as the length of the wormhole connecting those two points. The length of the wormhole is going to be proportional to t left plus t right and independent of t left minus t right. Okay, are there any questions so far? Okay, this is the semi-classical space-time description. As you are by no doubt now familiar, there's a dual boundary description of the same physics, or at least people keep telling me that. This same space-time can be described by a CFT, or rather it can be described by two CFTs. One CFT lives on the left boundary, and one CFT lives on the right boundary, and together, these CFTs can describe this same space-time. And if I consider the large black hole in de Sitter space, then we even know exactly what the state of the CFT is that describes that. It's the thermofield double state. The thermofield double state describes, let's say, the t equals zero slice of the CFT, as in the state at zero time on both the left and the right boundary. And that's given by this expression. If you trace out the right boundary, you get a thermal state on the left boundary, and vice versa. They have an entanglement entropy that's extremely well explored by this stage that's equal to the entropy of the black hole. And overall, they're in a pure state. They each purify each other. That is the state of the two CFTs at t left equals zero and t right equals zero. If I want to know the state of the CFTs at some other time, then I just need to evolve with the corresponding Hamiltonian on each side. So as a function of t left and t right that are now not necessarily equal to zero, this is given by, in this convenient energy eigenstate basis, t left plus t right, And we again see this behavior that things can only be a function of t left plus t right and not t left minus t right, because there's a time translation symmetry, a time-like killing vector, well, a killing vector that's time-like outside the horizon that is relating things that are separated by t left minus t right. Okay, so this is the state at zero time, and this is the state at any other time. Right, and so now there is a question, a motivating question, and the question is this. We think that things in the bulk are dual to things on the boundary. What is it on the boundary that is dual to the fact that this wormhole is getting really long at late times? What is that fact? And the conjecture is that the thing that is dual to the fact that the wormhole is getting very long, to the size of the wormhole, the thing that is dual to that in the state is the complexity of the state. That's the conjecture, and part of this talk is going to be a successive rigorization of that conjecture. Good. Any questions so far? Okay, what is complexity? Well, complexity is a distinct quantum property, distinct from many of the other quantities that people have been considering. What complexity is not is the same thing as entanglement. It's also not the same thing as entropy, and it's certainly not the same thing as entanglement entropy. It's a somewhat more fine-grained quantity than we're used to considering, which is part of the reason it can keep growing at late times. Instead, it's something else. Now, in fact, there's a huge number of definitions of complexity, and a huge number of different kinds of complexity. The kind that I'm going to be interested in, the kind that was conjectured to be dual to the size of the wormhole, is the circuit size complexity of the state of the wave function. What does that mean? That means the minimum number of gates, quantum gates in this case, that are required to prepare the state, starting in some reference state. Yeah, I think of this about as being a property of states rather than of partitions of states, yeah. Okay.
So what is the fiducial state that you start with?
Good. Okay, excellent question. So first of all, I'll explain how this works classically for people who may not have seen gate complexity before, and then I'll explain what I'm going to do here. So to prepare the state, you need to start in some, as I had the word reference state written down, you call it a fiducial state. So classically, for example, if you have, the first thing you need is a reference state. If you have a classical computer, that might be an input that reads just 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0 in every state, in every register. I'm going to imagine that there are n bits. The second thing you need is another thing, which is a basis of states. You better make those states universal, otherwise you're not going to be able to make everything. So some classic choices in computer architecture are NAND gates or NOR gates or AND gates. Let's give ourselves NOR gates and AND gates. And then the question is, starting in the reference state and applying these gates, however I see fit, what is the minimum such circuit measured by the total number of gates required to prepare the state in question? So classically, I might ask, I want to prepare the state 01101. Now, it's clear that classical state complexity is a rather trivial kind of thing because the number of possibilities aren't very large. The number of possible classical states of n qubits is 2 to the n. Each one can be either 0 or 1. And therefore, the complexity is upper bounded. The complexity is certainly upper bounded by n, because to each register, I can either do a not or I can not do a not. Yes. And that, in that manner, I can prepare any state. Yes?
Well, as you have defined it, do you mean, so you're defining complexity quantity to be some sort of asymptotically defined large number of, because if you change the set of universal gates, the exact number will change. So what exactly is the quantity?
Absolutely. So, relative to a given reference state and relative to a different basis of gates, this is a rigorously defined concept, even non-asymptotically. For this reason, often, for example, in computational complexity theory, people ask about reasonably crude divisions like polynomial versus exponential, which is not going to be sensitive to the basis of gates, but we're actually going to be asking a slightly more fine-grained concept question than that. Yeah.
You're having your rule state be pure and you're keeping that. Classically, classical computation is irreversible, it contains erasure. Are you sure you don't want to be using reversible classical computation, which has a different basis?
I absolutely could. I'm not...
The difference is the polynomial overhead, but if you're doing something more fine-grained, then you might...
Yeah, I'm not going to be doing anything more fine-grained classically, but you're absolutely right that classically, it's a NOT gate. The NOT gate is fine because it's reversible. I'm going to struggle to find a quantum version of the AND gate without erasing. That is a subtlety that I'm not going to have to be worrying about today. You know that classical computation is... anything that can be done classically can also be done reversibly classically. So it's not really that's a subtlety I'm not going to have to worry about.
So classically, all ones is the most complicated.
That's right. Classically, all ones is the most complicated. I do a NOT gate on every gate, and that requires n gates. So the complexity is upper bounded by n, and for that reason, classical state complexity is not a very interesting quantity, because it maxes out so soon. That's why when people are talking about classical complexity theory, they typically ask about not classical states, as we're asking here, but about classical functions. There are not 2 to the n classical states, but states that take n qubits to, functions of n qubits that say take n qubits to 1 qubit, there are 2 to the 2 to the n there. They're a doubly exponential, which is why people can make an interesting classification into, you know, P and NV versus things that require exponential resources. Yeah?
Wouldn't it make more sense to use a Kolmogorov complexity?
Absolutely not, no. Kolmogorov complexity is a... Kolmogorov complexity is about the size of a minimum Turing machine that will make a... about the size of the program on a given Turing machine that will make a given state. And that's not asking about the same... That's not asking about the same kind of resources that we're interested in having scarce in this case. As well as being generally uncomputable. Okay, so that's why no one really talks about classical complexity theory. If you were determined to talk about classical complexity theory, I could ask the following question. Suppose I start with my reference state, and I just start randomly throwing down gates, doing some random walking gate space. What is the complexity as a function of time, as a function of the number of gates that I've thrown down? Well, I think it's pretty clear that to begin with, the first gate I throw down in let's say I'm just throwing down not gates. The first gate I throw down increases the complexity by one unit. The second gate I throw down probably increases the complexity by one unit, but with very small probability, a 1 over n probability, takes me back to zero complexity, because if I do a not on a not, it's like there was no not. And so I'm just back to the reference state. But for a time of order, the maximal complexity of a time, it grows linearly up to about n over 2. It's going to grow linearly, and then it'll start curving off as I start accidentally hitting not gates. When I get up near of order root n, that'll start happening, and then it'll happen more often as I get up to order n. And then once it gets up to n over 2, it'll then start just random walking, just fluctuating around there, the complexity, as I throw down gates. So there's two facts. At earlier times, at times much earlier than the maximum complexity time, this function is going to grow linearly, because it's really unlikely that I'll have an accidental cancellation. And then it'll max out at the maximal complexity time, and it'll stay there, just bobbing around at the maximal complexity time, for a really long time. If I wait a really, really long time, then eventually I'll get a classical recurrence where the complexity will happen to fall back to zero again at a time that goes like 2 to the n, that's exponentially long. Okay, so that is classical complexity. One takeaway, no point in thinking about classical state complexity. Another is that if you insist on thinking about it, you see this behavior where it'll grow linearly with n, the complexity, and then only when I happen to get shortcuts at times of order of a maximum complexity, it'll stop growing linearly and will even out. Okay, so now we are going to do quantum, the same questions quantum mechanically, and talk about quantum state complexity. Good. So the first change is that rather than thinking about n bits, we're now going to be thinking about n qubits. And rather than this being represented like that, we're going to represent it as a quantum state, a quantum reference state. And I guess rather than having the basis of gates be not gates and AND gates, they're going to be unitary matrices, low dimensionality unitary matrices, say random two by two unitary matrices, to turn them into quantum reversible gates. And now, how many states are there? Well, a generic state looks something like this. It's got, as you know, it'll have overlap with every eigenbasis. How many eigenbases are there? There are 2 to the n basis states, plus 2 to the n similar. I guess 2 to the n minus 2, if we're going to be accurate, subject, of course, to one normalization constraint and one phase projection constraint. And so now you can ask, what is the generic state complexity of a quantum state? And the first thing to say is that the answer to that question is infinity. The reason it's infinity is that quantum states aren't discrete, but I'm throwing down a discrete set of bases. So it had better be, so trying to hit some continuous real, or in this case, complex number with some discrete set of bases is impossible. They have a different order of infinity even. And so for that reason, I'm going to need to have some tolerance when we're doing quantum mechanics. I'm going to have to say it's good enough if I reach a state that's really close in the inner product sense to the state I'm after, if the inner product for the state I'm after and the state I get is close enough, then I'm going to declare victory. Sorry, that's not the reference state, that's a target state that I'm going for. If I manage to make some phi that's really close to the target state, then I'm going to declare victory. Okay, so with that tolerance, the answer then becomes finite, for finite epsilon. And now I can ask how many, the first question I can ask is how many orthogonal states are there, completely orthogonal states? And the answer to that question is 2 to the n, just as it was classically. The basis states, there's 2 to the n basis states. There's no more completely orthogonal states than there are classically. But quantum mechanically, if I ask how many almost completely orthogonal states, how many almost orthogonal states there are, and then the answer to that question is 2 to the 2 to the n. It's doubly exponentially large, not singly exponentially large. And the fastest way to see this is just to think about the diagonal states, which are where I replace every alpha by either plus 1 or minus 1, suitably normalized. And it's clear that almost all, so those are diagonal states that are jutting out at every diagonal from all the bases in Hilbert space. It's clear that since I'm choosing plus or minus 1 from 2 to the n numbers, that's the number of states there are. It's also it's almost as clear that almost all of those, all but an exponentially small fraction of pairs of diagonal states, have a tiny, tiny overlap, an exponentially small overlap. So I guess this goes under the claim that Hilbert space is huge, doubly exponentially large, and for that reason, quantum state complexity can be an interesting quantity. Yeah. So at the level of sophistication that I'm at, this number is double exponentially large, and that's all I need to know. There are certainly going to be log n corrections. Actually, the correct answer is going to be way larger than this, because almost all diagonal states are almost completely orthogonal, whereas I'm only declaring victory, you know, when I get to within very close of the reference state. So actually the number is going to be indescribably larger than this, but still double exponentially large. Yeah.
So the way we do this in quantum information is typically kind of counting how many spheres of radius epsilon fit in the orthogonal.
Yeah, that would be a
sphere, and then you can see that it's 1/ε to the 2 to the n.
So it depends on epsilon.
Absolutely. It does depend on epsilon, as both of you have said, but it's not strongly dependent on epsilon in the sense that it's double exponentially large, and that's all you need to know. Yeah?
What specifies the number? So the alphas are quantum rules. The first one was about just the basis states.
Right.
And all but one alpha was 0, and one alpha was 1. Now you're taking some rule for the second line, you're taking some rule of just allowing again the alpha to be either 0 or 1 and something.
Sorry. I do recognize my presentation wasn't clear now. What I'm trying to do is I'm saying how many states are there. So one way to do it would be what the gentleman in the audience suggested, which is just to break up Hilbert spaces into little spheres and demand and ask how many little spheres there are of radius epsilon in Hilbert space. Yeah. Another question, I gave a what I thought was a more intuitive way to see immediately that the answer is going to be double exponentially large, which is to consider just the diagonal states and see that there's already doubly exponentially many of those, even though they're all almost completely orthogonal, though not exactly orthogonal.
Right. Any two of them are likely to be orthogonal.
Right.
That doesn't mean any one of them is orthogonal to all of the others.
That's right. So you can do a pruning that'll make it all work out. I think it's reasonably, since there's doubly exponentially many of them, it's pretty clear you can do the pruning, but okay. Any other questions before I move on? The only thing I'm trying to establish is that this is double exponentially large. I was giving, I thought, a slick argument that got you there. Okay. How many circuits are there? Well, every time I make a circuit, let's say I've got a circuit that has two ins and two outs, a unitary two circuit, I can choose amongst the n possible nodes which one of those two are going to be the two inputs to the gate I'm putting down. So if I just have one 2x2 unit tree, the number of possible circuits is, well, with one gate is n choose 2. With m gates is n choose 2 to the m, possibly with some redundancy, which is roughly equal to n to the 2m. So if I have m gates, if I want to make almost, you know, if I want to be able to simulate these, to generate these orthogonal states, these almost orthogonal states from the reference state, I'm going to need a number of gates that's exponential. In other words, the quantum state complexity is going to be exponentially large and isn't going to max out for exponentially large. But on the other hand, you're going to get the same behavior as you did quantum mechanically. Just now scaled. If I start throwing random gates down and ask about the complexity of that state as a function of time, it's going to grow to 2 to the n, and it's going to grow linearly, roughly speaking, for a time 2 to the n, until I start getting cancellations when I'm approaching the maximum complexity, and then it's going to start oscillating around the maximum complexity. And then, of course, there'll be a quantum recurrence time when everything will come back to itself, but that'll take a really long time now. The quantum recurrence time is the exponential of the quantum recurrence time. It's 2 to the 2 to the n. Okay, so this is a good candidate, therefore, to be dual to the size of the wormhole. It's a good candidate because it grows linearly with time, like the size of the wormhole, and it grows linearly with time for an exponential time. Yeah. It's not a process with a fixed recurrence time, but if by the time I've thrown that many gates down, it's likely that at some stage I come back to the reference state. There are just that many states, so if I throw that many, if I keep moving through the states at random by throwing down gates, then if I hang around that long, I will on average have returned once during that period to the any state I choose. And your first question was, yeah, this is a good approximation to the average complexity. I'm only really going to be considering this little region here anyway, so it's not going to be that important what happens at late times, but that is the idea. Yeah.
So I want to ask a question that I asked you a few days ago, just to make sure that I completely understand. You wrote down this quantum recurrence time that's doubly exponential, and I was trying to understand. So if you think about
Okay, I'm going to cut this question off because otherwise I'm not going to talk about wormholes and everyone's going to be very disappointed. You can ask me afterwards or at the end. Good. Okay. So we have an excellent candidate here in the complexity, which grows linearly with time for what can be dual to the size of the wormhole. And so in this original papers about what can be dual to it, the original conjecture was that the complexity is dual of the boundary state is dual to the length of the wormhole, measured in ADS units.
Adam, am I allowed to ask a really stupid question?
Yeah, if it's really stupid. If it's smart, then I'll be angry.
Your gates, I presume now, are not just going to be things like not and and. Those keep you within the basis, so you're going to change our...
Yeah, sorry, let's make these... So now that I'm promoting everything to quantum mechanics, I'm going to make these gates... I'm going to say give myself just some unitary two matrix, some computational universal two unitary matrix that I can choose to apply to any pair of gates, any pair of input qubits.
And I guess those take you outside of the basis.
Those... There's some theorem that... In fact, if I just choose these unit trees at random, then unless I'm really unlucky, I will end up with something that'll cover the whole basis. It's called universal. In fact, it's even universal for functions, not just for states. Okay, so statements about this conjecture. First of all, LADS is the correct length scale for large black holes. For small black holes, the conjecture has to put in an R Schwarzschild there to get sensible results. Black holes are much smaller compared to the ADS scale. Not really clear what to do for intermediate size black holes. The second thing to say is that this is impressive, but it's not that impressive. At the moment, as I've presented it, and in fact as it was originally presented, the only evidence for this conjecture is that this grows linear with time and this grows linear with time. And you can bet that, you know, if this had grown quadratically with time, you just take the square root of this quantity, and then you get something that grows linearly with time. So you shouldn't be overwhelmed by how impressive this is.
So you just mentioned it grows linearly on time. Is there like rigor? Can you make that statement that complexity grows linearly all the way rigorous?
I'm absolutely not going to make it rigorous. It grows stochastically at very early times compared to two. Well, let's remember how it works for the NOT gates. For the NOT gates, if I throw down the NOT gates, it's clear that it grows linearly, and then at around root n, I get my first unlucky thing that happens, and I hit something that's already a 1, and then it starts tailing off. The same behavior is going to be the same true here, but if you take the square root of 2 to the n, it's 2 to the n minus over 2, and it's still exponentially large.
Supposedly with that statement just made about complexity of area is interesting when you're not very near beginning, right?
I am going to discuss what happens at exponentially late times, which is the question you're interested in, and the question that Ning is interested in later. So we'll get to that later. Okay, so this, not a tremendous amount of evidence, but I'm gonna present later in the talk much more evidence for conjectures along these lines, in which we're gonna perturb pretty much everything. We can't quite say it's the length of the wormhole because that's not covariant. What we can say is that it's the length of a geodesic that stretches from one boundary to another. In fact, that's what's meant by length. That's of course infinite, but only because of this sort of divergence near the boundary. If we cut that off, or if we just regulate it, we'll find that the length of the wormhole grows linearly with time. Anyway, in retrospect, this was quite a bad idea, this length idea, because, for a number of reasons. You can take lines and wiggle them in space to make them longer, wiggle them in time to make them shorter, and generally, if you perturb the system at all, these they'll just start going totally crazy, and it won't be robust in any sense. So the conjecture was improved by Susskind and Stanford to say that the complexity of the wormhole isn't equal to the length of the wormhole, it's equal to the volume of the wormhole. Again, you have the problem with having to choose an arbitrary length scale, which for large black holes is meant to be LADS. And the volume now is the volume of the maximal slice, the slice of maximum spatial volume that connects the two sides of the wormhole. Which for late times will generally hew to something that's called the maximal surface, the surface of surface of maximal volume that lives about halfway in from the Schwarzschild radius. The maximal surface just goes and loiters at that distance away from the horizon. You can't now wiggle in space because it's a space-filling thing. You can wiggle in time, but the insistence is that you choose the surface of maximum volume, and we still need the length scale. Now, the new work that is promised in this line here is going to change this. Is going to change this again. The third version of the conjecture. If I come back to you with three conjectures, one after another, I'm not sure whether you should be impressed at how refined the conjecture now is, or distrustful that I've had to try three times. But the new version of the conjecture that I'm going to describe to you is going to make it not related to the length of the wormhole and not related to the volume of the wormhole. It's instead going to make it related to the action of the wormhole. Specifically, if I consider this as my left point here, anchor here. Let's take it down a bit. This is my left anchor here, and this is my right anchor up here, my T left and T right. The new conjecture is going to invite you to consider the Wheeler-DeWitt patch, take an ingoing past and future directed light cone from the boundary. Do the same on that side. Oh, these are better meet, otherwise I don't have a square. Cut that off. And so this is the Wheeler-DeWitt patch in here that you would construct from this in this manner. It's clearly a covariant description. It just makes reference to light sheets.
It's called Wheeler-DeWitt because it's one state in quantum gravity.
Yeah, so it would be the Wheeler-DeWitt evolution that would move you from different states here. And this is the total... great, yeah. Whatever those right words are, it's going to be the... Yeah, if I knew something on one state, it would tell you everything about every other state in there. Okay, so I'm going to consider this volume in here, this space-time volume, now no longer codimension 1, now codimension 0. And I'm going to claim that the complexity is equal to the action of that Wheeler-DeWitt patch. So one thing that's immediately nice about this prescription is that I don't have to I don't need what? So I'm measuring in units of h bar. Is that I don't have to, except for h bar, put in any dimensionful quantities into this expression. I don't, for example, have to invoke if you have a better idea for what action to put, unit of action to put in a fundamental quantity than h bar, then you should let me know. I don't have to put in any length scales. So here I had to put in an LADS, or that became our Schwarzschild for very small black holes in order to make everything work out. Here I don't have to do any of that. The action divided by h bar is naturally dimensionless, but nevertheless recovers in the appropriate limits the answer I would get from large ADS black holes for large L and small ADS black holes for small L. Now I'm not going to have time to tell you about one of the big... I'm going to come back and describe this conjecture a bit more. I'm not going to have time to tell you very much about the one of the big motivators for this work, which is trying to connect this conjecture, which is about complexity, to ideas in computer science about the maximum rate of computation that any computer can perform. So we're familiar from the work of Bekenstein, Busseau, et al. With the idea that there's space-time energy limits on the maximum amount of information that can be stored given limited resources. It's, you know, the area divided by 4g h bar, or it's the energy times the length divided by h bar. That's the amount of information that can be stored. You might hope that there would also be bounds on the amount of information that can be processed, some sort of time-dependent version of these bounds. And that's sort of what complexity is doing for us here. I'll just tell you, rather than write on the board, you know for information storage that those bounds are quite rigorous. You also know that black holes saturate those bounds. You might hope that the same is going to be true for information processing, though there are not nearly so rigorous reasons to believe it. There are good thought experiments involving taking huge piles of hard drives and collapse, and eventually they're undergoing gravitational collapse, that tell you that black holes have to be the densest information storers. There isn't really any same reason for information processing, but nevertheless, there are some conjectures along these lines. There are two rigorous theorems, which I won't tell you about, but the two rigorous theorems aren't actually directly relevant to what we're doing. They're more inspiration for a paper I read, for a paper that was published in Nature by Seth Lloyd from sort of 1999, in which he conjectured a bound on the total amount of information that can be processed per unit time. And his bound was that the number of gates that you can fit into a quant and process per unit time is less than 2 times the energy times the time divided by pi h bar. This is really, really fast. It's about 10 to the 40 times as fast as a modern laptop. It also appears to be violated, at least as a bound on complexity, if you choose cat states, highly entangled states of very different energy. But we're going to be considering semi-classical states, so we're not going to have to worry too much about that. A very confusing fact is that this is an equal sign here, which means that it seems to be basis independent and tolerance independent. And I could talk more about that, but there are reasons to believe this formula, despite the fact that it depends on the basis.
Doesn't this have a species problem? There's a large number n of species. Shouldn't there be an n in
there? No.
Is there a significance to having the complexity already meant that the time equals, I mean, the basic black hole state is already has some complexity?
Yeah, absolutely. That's true of all of these. I'm just running out of time. Maybe you can ask that in a question at the end, but I will just finish this thought and then come to that question. Okay, so so now let's just take that bound as read, and we can discuss it more later, and ask what this means for this. You might think that this bound on computation, in fact, it's meant to be a bound on the number of gates that you can implement in a given time, given a given energy. If you imagine that was saturated by black holes, that actually gives you allows you even to write in the constant here. And the answer is rather nice. So we have our black hole state. And we're asking for the rate of change of action. So by here, I really mean the action. I mean like the Einstein-Hilbert action with all the matter Lagrangian, better include the Gibbons-Hawking-York boundary terms. I mean the full action as a function of time. We're asking for the rate of change of that as a function of time. So if I advance time on the left, I lose a bit and I gain a bit. Actually, I gain this bit and this bit. I lose that bit and that bit. And I'll very briefly tell you that this bit doesn't matter because at late times, if I consider very late t lefts, because this region here is going exponentially to zero. This bit and this bit, the bits outside the horizon. Sorry, what I've done here is I've taken one causal patch and then I've advanced time on the left by a little bit and I have a new causal patch. And I've lost that bit, I've gained that bit. These two cancel by time translation symmetry. Everything outside the horizon exactly cancels. The only bit that contributes at late times is that. There's all sorts of contributions to the action in here. There's corner contributions, there's boundary contributions, there's bulk contributions. Turns out the only bits that don't cancel are the boundary contribution at the singularity from the extrinsic curvature, the boundary contribution at the horizon, and the bulk contribution. They're all individually quite complicated, but together they cancel and give a very nice answer that at late times, the rate of change of the action of the Wheeler-DeWitt patch is given by 2m. And so this formula is true for small black holes, intermediate black holes, and large black holes. It's also true in any number of dimensions. There are no factors of the dimensionality in here. This is just that's just what the answer is. So if I plug this into the Lloyd bound, I can make a guess for what this complexity is. I can fix the numerical constant in there, and I can get the conjecture that the complexity is equal to the action of the Wheeler-DeWitt patch So I'm going to make two assumptions. I'm going to assume that this Lloyd bound applies, and I'm going to assume that since we've got a black hole, it's saturated. And we get this formula. The complexity is equal to pi, 1 over pi h bar, times the action of the Wheeler-DeWitt patch. Which is quite a handsome formula, because it means there's no dimension-dependent factors in there, there's no anything that depends on the size of the black hole. This is just what the conjecture is. And you can see that if the action advances by pi, then the complexity advances by 1. So if e to the is advances from 1 to minus 1, then you increment the complexity by 1. So this is the new conjecture that we have. There's a number of ways to test it that I'm unfortunately not going to be able to describe to you now, except in very brief terms. One is you can take the black hole and wrap it in a spherical shell, like a Dyson sphere that you wrap around the black hole, and you can ask, what does that do to the rate of change of complexity? And the answer that these, in fact, all give you, is that the mass of the Dyson sphere does not contribute to the rate of change of complexity, which is sort of the right answer. It's just some inert shell that's sitting there. And the only effect is that the black hole, the rate of complexification of the black hole slows down because you put it in a gravitational potential from the shell. It slows down by one gravitational time dilation factor, one gravitational redshift factor, which is exactly the right answer you would expect. If you take a computer and put it in a gravitational well, you expect it to slow down by a gravitational time dilation factor. There's another set of extremely beautiful things that I'm not going to be able to describe, but if anybody has seen how it works for this conjecture, when that used to be the conjecture, it basically works exactly the same for this conjecture, but in many ways is easier to calculate, which is where I'm going to take this CFT, and rather than do a sort of static spherical perturbation, as I described by putting in a big shell, I'm going to ping it. I'm going to give it a tiny little tap at very early times. And then because of the butterfly effect, this tap is actually going to increase the complexity of the CFT at late times by a very great amount. It's going to contribute to the complexity by, it's going to change the complexity at late times because there's going to be chaotic evolution. And so that's going to change the complexity of the CFT. You can calculate how much you expect it to change the complexity of the CFT on the left, and then you can see what that does to the action in the bulk. And what that does to the action in the bulk is it puts a little shock wave in the action as a bulk that's very small at early times, but grows and grows and grows as the as it blue shifts, as it falls in from the boundary, and that creates a shock wave geometry whose action you can calculate. And sure enough, the bulk and boundary expectations precisely match up, which is a sort of impressive piece of evidence for this conjecture. Charged black holes, ground state complexity. Last words I will say, there is a principle of least action. Is there also a principle of least complexity? That's it. Okay, thank you.
What is the reference state?
Right. Okay, so as far as just taking time derivatives on the left goes, you can consider the reference state to be the thermofield double state, and you're measuring complexity relative to the... If I fix T right and just change T left, the complexity is at a minimum at T left equals 0. And then I can just... be considering myself to be applying gates on the left, just on the left, to the thermofield double reference state, and then the change from the thermofield double state complexity is just given that would be the reference state. Now, that gets you that's enough. That sort of simple picture is enough to fully understand the time derivatives of this state. You might also say, well, what about that infinity that I subtracted off, the infinite action that gets you from the left-hand state to the right-hand state? And in that case, that's a question about ground state complexity, about the complexity of the sort of thermophile double state, or for that matter, you could ask the same question in just empty ADS space. And in that case, we think that there's some tensor network the thing I described before, time evolution on the left, doesn't change the entanglement. It just, these are just sort of acting up, these gates. We might think that the ground state complexity sort of prepares this whole state, the left and right entanglement, and that the divergence of the complexity the divergence of the action at the boundary corresponds to a UV divergent of the complexity of this state. And so I would, the short answer to your question is that the ground state complexity measures the whole number of gates required to prepare sort of the whole thing, the whole entangled.
Starting from
a product state, let's say.
And the gates, if I, so far, yeah. The Hamiltonian for the full system is the sum of the Hamiltonian to the left and the Hamiltonian to the right. But the gates that I'm applying to get this complexity, are they also local in that sense? Or are there gates that are...
No, they better not be. I mean, if they're going to change the entanglement, they better not be.
Wait, why do they change the entanglement?
If you start off with just a full-up product state, then there will be no entanglement. These gates, I mean, the idea is that there's going to be some tensor network here that before you might have conjectured lived on the maximal slice, and now you might conjecture sort of lives everywhere in this patch or something that that prepares the entire state from the product state. Yeah.
So, I mean, if I understood the answer right, all that's happening if you move the left end point a little bit is phase rotation of individual elements of your Hart-Lockin state.
Yeah, in
why
the. So time evolution is always just, if you break things down in energy eigenbasis, is just phase rotating the energy eigenstates. It increases the complexity. I mean, if you want to apply the. There's some unitary that does that. If you want to construct that unitary out of gates, you're going to need some non-zero number of gates to construct that unitary. That's the idea. I mean, the idea is, yeah.
And can I follow up with one?
Yeah.
These three formulae, if I translate them into string theory, suppose they did translate, the first two care about both L string and L ADS. The first one cares about L ADS, the second cares about alpha prime in G or L plus, if you like, and L ADS. The third one only seems to care about G string.
You mean because there are G's in there, but no LADSs?
That's right. There's only H bar, which I translate very nicely, only translates in G string. Why is that?
That is a question I have not considered. There's a cosmological constant term. I mean, part of this action is the LADS does sneak in, because part of the, you can express the cosmological constant term in terms of LADS. Beyond that, I wouldn't know what to say. But
yeah. Hi. So I had a question about why the doubly exponential time. How to think about that in the context of transitions from the saddle point solution of the eternal ADS black hole to the thermal ADS. That seems to happen in a time that is not doubly exponential.
Yeah.
So is there some sense in which you understand why the quantum recurrence time on the complexity side is just not a relevant quantity that you'll ever get to?
Okay, so there's sort of three timescales here. There's polynomial time, forget about classical. There's three timescales. There's polynomial timescales during which the complexity is increasing linearly. There are exponential timescales during which it's maxed out and it's sitting there forever. And then there's doubly exponentially rare fluctuations in which it comes down. Now, you're asking how does that boundary picture correspond to a bulk picture in which I have this large ADS black holes, and in polynomial times, the complexity increases, but at exponential times, something funny happens. And the funny thing that happens is that you have a very large black hole in ADS, there is a probability for the whole black hole to just spontaneously evaporate and turn into radiation. The instanton that will mediate that will be the small black hole instanton. And that's rare, but it's not that rare. It takes it's exponentially rare. It goes like e to the minus the entropy of the system. So what I want to say is that that exponentially rare thing that happens, that instanton that messes up the semi-classical description of the geometry, you shouldn't associate that with the recurrence, because it's not like when you're done with that, the wormhole is short again. It's more like when you're done with that, the whole semi-classical picture is now broken down. So I want to associate those events, not with the recurrence time, but with this time, 2 to the n, on which the sort of intuitive linearly increasing complexity breaks down. In fact, that's a nice test. It's not a particularly profound test, but it's a nice thing that matches up between the two sides, that they both break down at the same time. The linear increase in complexity breaks down at an exponential time. The semi-classical description of the bulk breaks down at an exponential time.
So then is the statement that we shouldn't take this doubly exponential recurrence time as, like, that limit is in some sense not a serious limit in the ADS-EFT picture?
I mean, this is definitely true as a statement about gates. As a statement about the semi-classical space-time in the bulk, I don't know. You might aspire that this means something in the bulk, but at the moment, I think we have no idea how to understand semi-classical space-time after an exponential time, certainly not as late as a double exponential time.
But also, this assumes that you're throwing down random gates, whereas you're not. You're actually evolving by some
unit
analogy too far, right?
I think a random gate model is probably going to be acceptable.
Right, well, it might be acceptable for some questions,
right,
but not when you push it all the way to the end.
Yeah, well, I mean, probably any structure that the Hamiltonian has that makes it deviate from being random gates is going to draw in this recurrence time. You know, if there's conserved quantities, that'll draw in the recurrence time. But it'll still be double exponentially long, almost certainly.
So what is actually the bulk analog of the unitary gates, the basis gates? What is the bulk counterpart of what you're going to escape with? Make one step in complexity.
Good. Okay, so these things that are happening on the boundary are discrete. The things that are happening on the bulk is apparently continuous. How to reconcile these two? I guess this is,
but
just
even before reconciling, what is it, like you're evolving patch of the space time or somehow all of it a little bit up, or what is?
I would not want to try and resolve space time on the granularity of a gate.
So isn't that just the action change by the action change by a phase of time? Your many body wheel function rotate by pi, it's like one gate.
Yeah, I mean, that is the analog. The confusing thing is that gates are discrete and the action is apparently continuous in a semi-classical description.
Well, I don't think that's
question. Okay, well, Veronica, do you want to restate your question?
Forgetting about discrete and continuous, what is it on the other side?
Oh, well, then, sorry, your answer is right. It is advancing the action that corresponds
it's
to a gate.
Evolving from one body slice to the next, but for some pre-specified sort of time slicing,
it's when you've evolved enough up here that the action is increased.
But
by
how do you know what you're doing in the bulk? I see what you're doing on the boundary, so you're
right,
sort of moving that up.
Yeah.
In the bulk, of course, there is no, I mean, you can consider your state
that, yeah,
any sort of Gaussian slice,
yeah,
depends on that. Of course, the state is different depending on which Gaussian slice you take.
Yeah.
You get at the same point. So does this unitary gate somehow correspond to,
well, so there's, okay, you usually wouldn't want to say that a state on the bulk corresponds to any particular slice in the boundary. You might say that it's somehow the sum, this is just choosing a gate here corresponds to some non-physical gauge transformation on the boundary, and that you're just going to, you can choose any of them to be representative. So I wouldn't want to commit myself to saying that you're evolving from this slice to that slice, say. But if you did want to say that, there will be a natural interpretation, but you know, this is where the computation is happening in the bulk.
Okay, I think we're going to have to end the discussion there.